Hello and welcome to the Athletic Insider Show. I'm your host, Angela O'Mara. I'm here today with double board certified facial plastic surgeon, Dr. John Bartanian. Dr. Bartanian practices in Los Angeles, California, and today we're going to talk about facelifts, advancements, and techniques. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you for that generous introduction. It's a pleasure to be on your show, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, absolutely. Well, before we get started, because I know everybody's dying to learn just what is happening with facelifts these days, but before we get into our show and the details, why don't you tell our audience a little bit more about yourself, who you are, your practice in LA?
So my name is John Bartanian. I'm a double board certified facial plastic surgeon, and I've been in practice for almost 20 years here in Los Angeles in multiple areas. And I have a passion for both the surgical and non-surgical approaches to making people look rejuvenated and beautiful and natural. And I've both done research and looked at different angles to improve on the amazing techniques that we have inherited from our mentors.
You know, that's great. That's great. It's so great to hear that because, of course, we have so many mentors, or we've had so many great mentors in the facelifting realm, and especially in LA. And, you know, we have now obviously a large population of kind of baby boomers. I don't know if we still call them baby boomers these days, but, you know, people who are getting to the age of having a facelift, and of course, the younger side of the spectrum, which is still having fillers and injectables, you know, for their facial rejuvenation. But what's new with facelifts, and what are you seeing it there in the industry and out there in the practice in terms of what men and women are now looking for in terms of a facelift?
Yeah, so as the baby boomers become a very a large emerging population, people in general are living much longer and having a much higher quality of life, healthier, more active. And accordingly, what used to be a 50-year-old in the 1950s is different than a 50-year-old at, you know, in the 2020s. And so in line with that increased vitality, people want to look better and they don't want to look old. And of course, at some point in time, surgical procedures become necessary. And so the trends I'm seeing in facelift surgery are twofold. One is minimal procedures that people are doing to stave off aging, and more substantial lifting to correct for years of, I would say, neglect. And each one has a different approach and different pros and cons.
You know, I think for the average person, when they think about a facelift, they think of like the whole face gets lifted. But that's not necessarily true, right? In terms of the facelift, you kind of break it down into compartments, and it could be a lower face, a mid face, an upper face. So do you want to explain a little bit more to our audience just kind of what does entail a facelift? And of course, it would depend by the patient and the degree of aging on the patient. But what would kind of be just a perfect scenario for a facelift?
So there's different definition of facelifts, and there's different branded facelifts. But in general, there's, I would say, three categories. One is the neck, where you have to do a neck lift. Second is minimal amounts of neck and face work. And then third is a more deep and profound face and neck lift together. Generally, a facelift stops right around the cheek level. So the facelift doesn't automatically include rejuvenating the eyes or elevating the brows. Now, quite often it's done in conjunction, but by definition, a facelift is this part of the face. And a neck lift is obviously the neck lift. And usually they're done together. And then beyond there, there's different types of facelifts based on the depth and level of elevation and tissue movement.
And are there names for those depths that you mentioned?
Yeah, so again, there's several different types of facelifts, generally speaking. The most basic would be a skin-only facelift, where only the skin is elevated and lifted. Second level would be to go in there and reposition a little bit of the deeper tissues. There's a layer called a SMAS, and that layer is a kind of a tough leather-like layer of the deeper face. And so that can be pulled a little bit. The next level is to go and release some of the SMAS. And that's called a SMAS or sub-SMAS technique. And then the deepest level is to do what's called a deep plane or composite facelift, where the entire deep part of the face is released and repositioned. And of course, there's one even deeper than that, where some surgeons will go on the bone and release some of the tissues. And they all have different, again, pros and cons, and proponents of the technique.
So who would be like, what would kind of be a typical candidate for that skin-only facelift?
Yeah, so I think in my practice, nobody gets a skin-only facelift, because okay. The skin-only facelifts are easy to do. They're easy to do, but they tend to fail very quickly because skin is designed by definition to be flexible. So if you pull the skin, it may look good on the operating room table, but later on it looks a little pulled and it doesn't stand the test of time. Furthermore, skin-only facelifts tend to have increased scarring where we make some of the incisions because there's too much tension or pulling on that skin. The body is pretty smart. In response to that increased tension, it puts more collagen and more scar tissue. So in my practice, I never do a skin-only lift in general. But there's still some doctors who get good results with it. But it's a style of facelift where I would say most practitioners don't do.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I was actually at a luncheon a couple of days ago, and there was a lady who had clearly a facelift very recently. And it was so obvious from the like pulling and lumpiness on this side. And I don't know if she'd only had a skin only, you know, facelift, which is possible. But it was just not a good result. And she'd only had, I mean, she was quite new. I think she'd had the facelift about 6 weeks prior to me seeing her. But it should, I think, still have been enough time to allow for that to have corrected itself. It wasn't pretty.
No, I say that you don't see the good facelifts, but you do see the bad ones. Yeah. There's many, many ways of getting bad facelift. Now, after surgery, one has to always give some time for swelling to come down and for the tissues to look more normal. Yeah. So sometimes patients in the first couple of weeks may look a little different, but that's not the final result. But in my opinion, almost all surgeons are well-meaning and they want to do their best job. Mm-hmm. But if you don't know the long-term behavior of the tissues, the anatomy, mm-hmm. quite often in an effort to get a great result for the patients, many surgeons tend to over-tighten and over-pull, again, with good intention to try to get a better result for that patient. But they actually are doing a disservice by distorting natural the way the face is naturally and the tissue planes and the direction of the pull. And so, you know, I think I'm a beneficiary of some of my mentors, where we have learned that there's different techniques for different face types and different facial aging, and so we reposition the tissue so it looks rejuvenated and natural and beautiful, but natural being key, that you're not creating surgical changes that are artificial. You're keeping people looking normal, rejuvenated, and beautiful.
So what is the typical age of a facelift patient? Is there one?
Yeah, so I always tell my patients, I treat problems, not age. And so there are people who age differently, and so their numerical age is not that relevant. It's their motivation, how they feel on the inside, and the level of facial aging and neck aging that is present. Mm-hmm. I would say most of our facelifts start in the 50s and 60s, great majority. But I've done facelifts on much younger patients, especially people who are in the let's say, entertainment industry, and they have to, their face is part of their calling card, and they need to look good for obtaining certain roles. In that case, you have to go with the problem at hand. There's facial aging. It doesn't matter what age they are.
You know, I'm kind of glad you brought that up, because in LA, in Hollywood, in Beverly Hills, I mean, and I think in many other parts of the world too, and in terms of when you do talk about, you know, cosmetic surgery and its effect on people from, you know, self-confidence, self-esteem, job opportunities, you know, just all these other kind of spin-offs that seem to be happening and occurring in the lives of people who undergo good cosmetic surgery. But in LA, you know, face equals fortune. I mean, that's kind of what they say. So in the world of celebrities, and I know you can't mention names and HIPAA patient compliance and all of that, but do patients come in asking for specific looks of celebrities who they think have had a facelift, or they just want a facelift to get that look similar to a celebrity?
Sometimes they do, but I always tell people that, you know, each person is different and we want to create the better version of that person. Furthermore, you know, many celebrities, when they take photographs or are on camera, they have the benefit of excellent lighting, makeup. Quite often, in addition to surgical procedures, they've done other treatments. And so we want to look at the person and make, at least in my practice, the better version of themselves. Of course, we can draw inspiration from various celebrities or models who look timeless and elegant, and both male and female, and take that inspiration. And I take that inspiration and I figure that in my calculation of what we're going to do for the patient, so that we can I can approach that the vibe that the patient is seeking in the result.
Now, when a patient comes into you, do you you know, like you mentioned, you know, where people are living longer, they're living healthier. Do you have any like pre-surgical, I don't want to say requirements, but recommendations for a patient?
Yeah, so we do. So there's two levels to that. One is we want to make sure that we're doing elective surgery on patients who are very healthy, so any surgical risks are almost nil. So we do a pretty thorough a workup, and for many patients, it's like an executive physical. So it's a nice experience to see everything. And I look at all of those numbers, the labs, the EKG, the reports personally, as well as running it by my anesthesiologist. So that's a basic. On top of that, I always tell patients to get on a couple of weeks before surgery on a regime of balanced diet, a good multivitamin. We do prescribe some anti-inflammation and anti-bruising herbal medicines during, like, in the recovery period. So we try to combine all of the above approach in optimizing our patients before and during, before surgery and during recovery.
Now, I've kind of read some things in the past on vegetarian diets, and sometimes the healing of tissue in a vegetarian patient can be somewhat compromised. Is there any truth to that? Or,
well, there can be, but it's very hard to categorize, because there may be some vegans or vegetarians who have a fantastic diet because they're so careful that they get all their nourishment, there's no issues. Conversely, there may be some vegans or vegetarians who don't get a balanced diet, but the same can apply to someone who's an exclusive meat eater, or someone who has a generalized diet, but they're not careful in getting all their nutrition. So it's about more the micro of how they're getting their nutrition than the broad category of what type of dietary regime they follow.
I think as well, in recent years, there's a lot more education to the vegetarian and the vegan diet, and the need to get all the correct supplements that your body needs, which you can get now, we find, from plants and grains, as well as from animal products. So, okay.
Yeah, so it's about the person's attention to, I guess, the details. again, you could be on a general diet and not take high quality food products. The same applies to someone who is in a particular diet, whether it's a carnivore diet or a high fat diet or a vegetarian diet, et cetera. So it's all about getting that balance. So we try to advise our patients beforehand to, at the minimum, to be able to take a good multivitamin a day, so there's no gaps in various vitamins, like vitamin K, that could be important in clotting and minimizing bruising and other bleeding-oriented type issues.
Yeah. Now, this might be a crazy question, but so you've talking about, you know, the average facelift patient, some being as young as 50, but 60s, 70s.
I have younger than 50, by the way. The youngest I've done is in their 30s.
Oh,
so wow. You have to customize. There is really no right answer. The right answer depends on the patient's motivation, how they look, the level of tissue and skin laxity, and what they're trying to do. And again, we talked about actors, but I've a very large group of patients who have, or executives, or people who are not in the entertainment business, but still have to have what I call front office duties. And they want to go into a meeting with confidence, and they're very fit. And interestingly enough, the people who are very fit have low body fat, and they tend to age faster or show aging in the face more, rather. And so in those people, and many chin tuck or many deep plane facelifts could really create an amazing vital look that looks natural and is in tune with their vitality and how their body looks, for example. So it's all very individualized. And that also applies to the type of surgery we do. Again, the key in my practice and what I preach is customization and individualization, because no two people are the same in anything they do. And that even applies to, sisters that I've operated on, or brothers, siblings.
You know, I was going to ask about couples. And so I didn't think about sisters or brothers. And so tell me a little bit more about, like, families. Do you know, like, do they come in together? Is a wife comes in, then the husband follows, or a sister comes in and the sister follows? How does that all work?
Yeah, in a sort of family dynamic, there's always the braver one, right? And so that person goes first, and the other person's like, well, if they do well, then I'll get it done too. So it could be something as simple as eyelids, or a facelift, or a neck lift.
Yeah.
And so I see that a lot. And sometimes they'll say, look, we're taking some time off. We want to do it in the same week so we can recover together and, you know, hire a nurse or whatnot. So there's different approaches. Sometimes the more adventurous one goes first, and the more cautious one waits, and usually they're emboldened, and sometimes they do it together. So it's kind of fun to see that in a family setting. If plastic surgery or facial plastic surgery is done correctly, with the right motivation, right surgeon techniques, good recovery, it could be very empowering, because you are, the person is gaining something very real and empowering. And so it emboldens other people who've seen that process to undertake that procedure, especially if the recovery was benign, which is the case for how we do a lot of our cases.
Yeah. I was reading an article the other day, and there was a phrase, I'm not sure who coined the phrase, but it was basically saying that facial plastic surgery and cosmetic dentistry can be considered like wearable art, because it's an investment, but it's an investment in yourself. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So not only is it wearable art, but I think more importantly, it's an investment in your system. It's like becoming a better athlete or becoming a bit smarter. And so if you can take care of things that were perhaps holding you back and let go of that inhibition, improve your confidence, that all helps you perform better, enjoy life more, be more content where you are. And I tell people, you know, I love traveling and I encourage people to travel, but you know, you go to a place for a week, 10 days, you come back, that memory is there, but the experience, you come back to the same reality. While if you took that time and did something that was bothering you, fixed it, that benefit stays with you for many, many years. In the case of, you know, we're talking about facelifting today, the facelift I do, the V-lift is a deep plane composite lift, and we'll talk about different what that means. But that facelift is essentially a once-in-a-lifetime facelift for a great, great majority of people. So it's an amazing investment, if you want to call that, in looking great for a long time. And in fact, if you look at how much potential money some patients can save in the form of temporary fillers, lasers, devices, is actually it pays for itself.
Yeah. I think it's time as well, because all those other treatments need maintenance, whereas this is, like, it's a once in a lifetime investment. Can we talk now a little bit more about the V-lift? Because I like that. I like that this is a once in a lifetime thing to do this particular, your particular signature technique. Can you explain to our viewers what a V-lift actually is and how you do it?
Yeah, so besides customizing the, I would say, an armamentarium of techniques, it's an entire toolbox of techniques that I have to each patient to make it very basic. So what I do is a deep plane composite facelift, and we go all the way up to the core of the eye to reposition these tissues, not just sideways, but at an angle that will restore a more youthful look. And the key is to release all the connections and join that with the neck. So you're moving the deep tissues of the face, which are connected to the deep tissues of the neck, in the same operation at different angles, of course. And what I do is I permanently attach these to bone and deep tissues, and in case of the neck, to the bone behind the ear.
Oh.
So what that means is these patients get a very robust rejuvenation, but we're not pulling skin. So they look rejuvenated. The before and afters are like, wow, but they look normal and natural. Now, there's some other tricks that depends, again, on the case that employ. One of them is to really release some of the tissues in this area so we can get a nice redraping of the jawline. And some other, again, ligament and tether point releases to make sure that we can reposition the tissues fully. Now, again, it varies from patient to patient. So I guess the most important factor is really the motivation and the intention on my part to customize each surgery to maximize the result based on that patient's aesthetic goals and what they were asking.
So then, in essence, the V-lift is lifting the tissues via the underlying structure so that when it's repositioned, it continues to move naturally as it would have done prior to surgery.
Correct. And again, the V is a little bit of a play on word. I like a V-shaped face. You know, as we get older, things come down and we start looking more square and boxy, especially on women. And that look is less feminine than, let's say, a heart-shaped face or a V-shaped face. So the V-lift comes from that. It's like a V-shape. And of course, it doesn't hurt that my last name starts with V. So I'm biased with that letter. But it also applies to the neck. Again, if you look at the progression as we all age, we lose that V-shape in the neck, and we become more square-shaped and less defined. So that angle applies in different angles, both to the face and the neck.
So can I call the V-lift the Vartanian lift?
You could call that. So I think V-lift is a little catchier. And again, the letter V is, of all the letters in the alphabet, is the one that I want my facial shape to resemble the most, right?
Yeah.
Or most of the best, at least.
And so what are the other, like you mentioned other tricks of the trade?
So again, I think all surgeons mean well, and but the key trick is to be able to release a number of different attachments, deep attachments. Some call them ligaments, but these are attachments of these tissues to the deeper bones. Now, interestingly enough, where those attachments are, that's also where the nerves that control the face live. So it becomes a little trickier. So for a lot of surgeons, it's an area where they would rather not play in because it can be intimidating. But if one knows the anatomy and has done this enough, it's actually very straightforward and very by the book. I liken it to a taxi driver in Rome, you know, taking little streets. For them, it's not a big deal. They know the streets. But if I were for the first time going to a new city, you know, I would be looking at my GPS and being very careful. That's an exaggeration. But once you do enough of these cases, the anatomy is actually very elegant,
yes,
self-explanatory, and it directs you into different directions. So you go in a particular way, you make a little turn, you see this structure, you slow down, you elevate that structure, then you're in the right plane, and you're able to proceed safely and effectively. It's beautiful anatomy, and the results are amazing. And I love doing it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, when you're talking about it, and it makes sense, I mean, where the nerves are, those are the danger zones, and, you know, and can result in things nobody wants. For the patient, doesn't want any kind of nerve damage or, you know, anything. So how does a patient really then find somebody to deliver the type of facelift results and safety that you mentioned?
Yeah, so I think we're actually lucky right now because in almost every major city in the world, there's some really talented surgeons. So I would say just look at their before and afters, meet with the surgeon, get a feel for what they do, mm-hmm. And ask them questions. The more I think patients learn about anatomy, different approaches, and the more surgeons they interview, the more they start getting a feel and an understanding for what can be a little intimidating of a field. But I think looking at before and afters is very important. I mean, if you're lucky enough to have a friend who already had this procedure done with the surgeon, that's great because then you have a direct word of mouth. So that's where I would start with. But looking at the before and after, that's very important. If you look any, you know, you want to look at the corner of the ear, if it's been pulled down a bit, that's a telltale sign that facelift was done. You want to look at the hairlines, if they've been modified, the contour of the ear, the corner of the mouth has been widened or not. So these are things that I will spend extra time during surgery to make sure it doesn't happen on my patients. But I see quite commonly in our patients who have had work done elsewhere, they may come in for other things.
Yeah,
and of course that could be also a reason to do a redo facelift, which we also do, to go in there and do it right and also fix some of the scarring and other things that could happen with certain types of facelifts.
Well, it's like you said earlier, you know, a bad facelift is obvious, right? Bad cosmetic surgery is obvious to regular people, you know, whereas these types of details that you're talking about, with, like you said, the corner of the mouth or the earlobe, are probably areas that most people really, that they're kind of, you know, such minor detail that they may not see them. But if you're pointing out that, you know, even in a face that looks good, just look for these other extra areas. And now that you've kind of been educated on those little telltale signs of not the most perfect facelift, maybe a good one, but it could be better. So really do your homework.
Yeah, I, again, with the way I approach things, I'm also doing a surgery for me because I'm a perfectionist when it comes to my work, and I try to foresee potential issues so it doesn't happen in our patients.
Yeah.
So sometimes you're right. Some people may not see these surgical telltale signs, but I see them and it bothers me and I don't want to see it in my own patients. So it doesn't happen.
I love as well, like you said, how now, because there's been so much great education and there's a lot of skill and artistry that really now in any major city in the world, you can find really top-notch, excellent plastic surgeons and facial plastic surgeons who do just phenomenal facelifts.
Yeah, so that's true. Now, the flip side is because of marketing, social media, a growth of all kinds of providers and practitioners getting into the aesthetic surgery realm, there's also a large number of non-specialists who are doing facelifts that maybe 30, 40 years ago would have been okay, but in my opinion, is subpar by today's standards. So it's a two-edged sword. That's your homework.
The lady I saw at lunch recently.
Perhaps, yeah. And it doesn't matter about location because sometimes, there are surgeons who have amazing marketing, great office location, superb, decor in their office and good PR, but they're not super gifted or knowledgeable in the realm of that particular surgery. So you got to be careful. And sometimes, surgeons are very good at a particular procedure, but not at the other. So in the old days, like the breast guys are great at breast, but they're not great at face and vice versa.
Yeah.
And that's one reason I only do face work, focus on a number of procedures and do them as best as I can.
That's wonderful. Let's just talk a little bit. There's so much more that we could talk about with facelifts, but what are kind of like reasons for facelift besides, well, I'm getting old and I don't really want to look, I feel younger than I look, but like weddings or movies.
Yeah, so
like what are the reasons why people undergo a facelift and what time frame do they need to plan?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And it's not like aging happens overnight. We're aging constantly. But sometimes there's a seminal event or looking at a mirror at a particular angle or someone taking a picture from the side that precipitates that, oh my God, what is this? And usually, I would say most patients is loss of of what we call the cervical mental angle, which is the neck jawline angle. It goes from being crisp to being more full. The appearance of jowling, or I call baby jowls. These are two of those things that usually motivate patients to come in and say, well, how can we fix this or this? Especially in patients who are younger. And of course, there's also patients who just, have a lot of skin laxity and deep tissue laxity and just look older than they used to when they were younger. Now, as far as the timeline for a surgery, I always tell patients the best time for a surgery is when it fits into your life demands. And that includes, big events and holidays and work. I generally tell people to take about 2 weeks off work and work duties. Most of our patients look good enough to go grocery shopping within a week, especially, with a hat or a little bit of a disguise.
Yeah.
But if one is preparing for, let's say, a wedding or an important event, the more time, the better. And I would say at least 2 weeks, 2 months rather, is a good minimum period of time, because after surgery, there's a period of time before the body completely heals itself. The lymphatics get reestablished, subtle daily swelling trends go down. There's a period where you look good enough to fool the world. That's 2 to 3 weeks. And there's a time where you're completely healed. That could be a couple of months to a year.
Okay. Yeah.
You mentioned
lymphatics, and you've mentioned lymphatics in the past today. And I'm seeing kind of more discussion on the importance of lymphatics in facial any procedure, but can you just explain a little bit more what that really means?
Yeah, so we have arteries and veins and capillaries. So the arteries bring the oxygenated, the blood that's got oxygen from your lungs, the good blood, and then they spread to these little blood vessels, the capillaries. Our bodies take in that oxygen and other nutrients, and then that oxygen-poor blood goes in the veins and gets pumped back to the heart. But these blood vessels are not like lead pipes. They're leaking. So in that process, a little bit of that blood or plasma leaks through, and the lymphatics are there to grab that fluid and bring it back to the heart. That's why when you're in a flight, your legs swell up, etc. So with surgeries, sometimes the lymphatics can be disrupted. That could delay that final result because you can get some subtle swelling, especially when you wake up in the morning. Now, what I've done to try to minimize that phenomenon is by leaving certain areas of the face undisrupted during surgery. So we're going deep to some of the lymphatics so that we can create the change we want while minimizing the disturbance to those blood vessels and lymphatics, with the hope that we can reduce that downtime. But nevertheless, any surgery is going to disrupt some of those lymphatic channels. And that's part of that quiet recovery phase. Again, the recovery phase where you look good enough to fool the world and show off your new facelift could be not that long. But there is a period that takes months before those lymphatics are fully reestablished.
Now, I think this is my last question, but again, I said there's so many things we can discuss with facelifts, but are there any, because really what you talked about is the lower face, like you said from here, and you mentioned the forehead and the eyes. Are there any other little tricks that you do with the aging face to make it look slightly more younger when you do a facelift?
Yeah, so again, it's highly individualized, and so some people, their facial and neck aging is more in the mid-face, for example. Mm-hmm. Mid-face is abandoned the under eye, which can create a very tired, unvital look. So in those cases, we're going to be elevating these tissues at an angle that is parallel to some of the deep anatomy. One of them is the angulation of what's called a zygomatic muscle, which is the big smile muscle. It roughly goes from below your cheekbone to the corner of the mouth. And I measure those angles. But at the end of the day, it's an aesthetic sort of decision based on the patient's aesthetic goals and the pictures that I look beforehand. Before surgery, I take literally about 30 pictures with and without flash. And I study those the night before surgery so I can almost have an x-ray in my mind of their anatomy. And I pair that with what the patient asked for. Some patients may say, I want the maximal result possible, really get these cheeks to the highest position, which I had when I was 19. Others may say, I want very minimal change in this area. So it all depends on, again, customizing, individualizing based on what the patient's concern areas are, what the anatomy will permit, what's within the realm of safety, beauty, and doability. The other area also that we will vary what we're doing is the neck. So on some younger patients, what I'll do is called a chin tuck, where I just do this component of the facelift underneath the chin. So what we do is we go in there, take some of the deep muscles and fat, and reposition these muscles. And so that's, I would say, one quarter of a facelift, but nothing is done on the sides of the face. So that's great because for some younger patients, they can restore their neckline. We may do some energy devices and other things in the face so they can look better with maybe less than a weekend downtime.
Oh, well, that's wonderful.
Which again, for many people who have work demands, you know, life demands, it could be a fantastic way station before getting a more substantial mini or real facelift, e-lift.
Yeah.
So again, different options for different needs.
Would you say, because you mentioned earlier about, you said some patients neglect So, you know, they come to you, they've never done anything, and they're 65, 70 years of age, and have more significant drooping or jowls, you know, than wrinkles. Well, then you just mentioned this younger patient who you can do this one technique, which is kind of like preserving them, I guess. If they do little things over the course of time, then they don't come with that level of neglect of somebody who's never done anything.
Yeah, and I explain to patients. Yeah, I explain to patients that really most people have two good facelifts in their lifetime left. So because every time surgery is done, especially if some surgeries that are done elsewhere, the tissue layers are disrupted, and that makes the next surgery more difficult and makes getting an outstanding result more difficult, which is even more reason to either go to the right surgeon or not take any shortcuts in, let's say, wanting to save money or whatnot. Because if a surgeon is, if a facelift is done wrong, the next facelift surgeon, no matter how talented he or she may be, the potential is lessened for improvement in general. So now, not every person that comes for a consult gets a facelift. There's many patients that I tell them that we can, with some minimal treatments, push that facelift date to a future date. I love doing facelift surgery, but again, different strokes for different folks. And so if someone I feel like they're too young and they don't really have the downtime, and we can solve their concern areas with various minimal procedures, then obviously I would recommend that as opposed to going to the straight to a facelift. The opposite is true. Sometimes I have patients, they raised their kids and now they want to come in and they think, you know, they can look amazing by doing a little bit of fillers or a little bit of Botox, and I have to tell them that that's not going to make a big difference. In fact, it may even be a waste of money, that it may be better to explore more foundational things like a facelift or a brow lift or surgical procedures that can give much better value and better results for that person.
Now, you say two good facelifts in a lifetime should be all that you need. Then does it depend on the age of the surgeon? Because if you wait till you're 60 or 70 to have a facelift and your surgeon is an older surgeon, then they might not be around to do that second facelift when you're older. But then, you know, again, from experience, an older surgeon would have more experience than a younger surgeon. So where do you educate patients at that level?
Yeah, it's a really tricky question. There's older surgeons who are not good, and there's young surgeons who are very good. You know, I would say generally, I think you want to have a surgeon who's at least 10, 15 years of experience. You also don't want a surgeon who is 2-3 years away from retirement in general. You know, again, whenever you generalize, you can make mistakes, but in general, those are good guidelines. Mm-hmm. 10 to 15 years, because it literally, no matter how well-trained a surgeon is, it takes a lot of operating on different types of anatomy. You know, you may have a great technical background, but every time you operate, you see something a little different. And so if you've had a couple of hundred facelifts under your belt, which takes a number of years, that equips you better in getting that top result safely than if you're not used to that. The flip side is also sometimes, you know, some surgeons may use older techniques and be a bit more less inclined to invest energy in that top level result if they know they're going to be retiring soon. So, but there's no, you know, again, it's all very individual. I would talk to patients, look at their before and afters, and base my surgical choice on that, or surgeon's choice on that.
Yes.
As well as surgical choice.
Well, John, thank you so much for being on the show today. Is there anything we haven't explored in the world of facelifts that we can close the show with, or any more, you know, recommendations for listeners and viewers as to how they can do to get the best result possible?
Well, it's actually a tangent. You were talking about bad facelifts. And so I sometimes see patients who had facelifts and they're okay with the results. They don't want another facelift, good or bad, medium, whatever the result is. They don't want any more surgery, but they're still concerned about some of the scarring and some of the surgical signs of previous surgery. And so quite often we can go in there and fix those under local in a quick procedure without doing a facelift, just taking out the scar, fixing this and that. And so that's always a nice little kind of rescue procedure that can be done in the office with very little downtime. And it can reduce some of the, I would say, you know, the stresses of a previously, you know, less than ideally performed surgery. So that's also available if someone is watching this podcast and they're done with the surgery. They don't want any more surgery, but they're looking for options in fixing some of the surgical scars or other telltale signs of previous surgery. That is quite often done too, and it's pretty easy to do. And it can bring a lot of value, self-confidence, and be a great procedure without doing a whole redo facelift, for example.
You know, that's great to hear because, I mean, I do think, and I see in many facelifts that the rescue procedure, like you said, it's just you can come to the rescue for that one little detail or one little area that just wasn't optimal. And you can fix it without major downtime, without major surgery, and probably without major cost.
Yeah, the same applies again. Going a little bit more involved, their patients will come in, they've had a facelift elsewhere or 10 years ago. They have some residual jowling and other things. And again, they're not interested in surgery. It's done. I did my surgery. I'm done with it.
Yeah.
In those cases, there's also pretty clever and I would say cool things that we could do with energy devices, very minor procedures in the office like microliposuction, fillers, this and that, to optimize the result so that we don't give up on the cause. Again, we don't have to go the surgical route, the facelift, redo facelift route, but there's other things we could do to, again, move the ball forward in the providing, you know, more self-confidence and a more beautiful, less aged look for the patient.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, Dr. Vartanian, again, thank you so much for being on the show today. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have you here. And I know for those viewers out there, you know, just this information that you have taken the time today to share with us is really beneficial. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always, I love talking about this stuff. And again, thank you for putting this series together. I hope it's beneficial to patients and providers alike. Thank you again.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. For those of you still with us, remember to watch next Wednesday for another exciting episode of the Aesthetic Insider.